And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. And today we're going to talk to three journalists and about the recent developments in, once again, Syria, which captures the headlines around the world. Anyway, this is where the big argument, the big tussle is taking place. And today is, of course, the 18th. It's the birthday of Martin Luther King, and Hollywood is acknowledging this by not nominating any black actors for any awards, top to bottom. And Spike Lee, bless his heart, is not going to attend. Good for him. It is maddening to watch this year in and year out. And, of course, in Flint, Michigan, where there are many, many black residents, the state has seen to it that they have water to poison themselves with. So Martin Luther King Day. But we'll be talking to Gerald Komen, and who is a journalist who works. You see his work in at RT, Russian Television, and also Global Research. We want to go into this matter of regime change, the U.S. policy of regime change, and we will talk later also with Steve Sahuni, who is in Syria, and we're going to get the latest update on the. Developments in the war front, and of course this, we'll be hearing about this issue of the Syrian town of Madea and how it's being propagandized, particularly by the U.S. and its allies. Some terrible, dirty tricks are being played on that subject. And at the latter part of the show, we will talk to Zafar Bengash of Crescent International. It's Crescent-Online.com, if you want to know. And there'll be some other matters. While we're waiting to speak to Gerald, I'm going to mention that, again, that I've brought up Hollywood not in a flattering way, but the film Trumbo has the lead actor has been nominated for an Academy Award. Let's hope he wins it. I said on the show last week that I do think everybody who gets a chance to see the film should do so. I should tell you, there's a very good article by a man named Roger D. Harris. It's in Counterpunch on January the 15th. And he tells why he thinks this is a particularly special film. Incidentally, Roger D. Harris belongs to a political movement in the United States and California that's trying to put socialist candidates on the ballot. And I know that Bernie Sanders says he's a socialist, but I mean, actually there are socialists who are trying to participate. It's very hard. You have to have money and a bunch of lawyers, actually. They will be very expensive lawyers, by the way, if you do get them. But the article makes a very convincing case that this is a rarity, and it's a one-off so far, in which the hero of the story is a member of the Communist Party U.S. and gets in trouble. And the villain of the piece is Hollywood and the U.S. government. So make sure you see Trumbo. I think it's still in town. But I think we're joined now by Gerald O'Coman. Are you there, sir?
Phil, how you doing?
Very good, and we're glad to be talking to you. You have been focusing on the subject of regime change, and you've written wonderful pieces on Syria, where there's a game being played to knock off the government of Syria. And but also, and this is outstanding in my view, you've been talking about Burundi, a story that's not being covered. So I want to get into both. But let's just begin with, I would like to talk about this latest developments in Syria and your estimate of what's going on. First is that in 2011, the United States and its allies destroyed the government of Libya, and they murdered the leader, Muammar Gaddafi. And then they announced that they were the next stop of the regime change express was going to be Damascus. So that was 2011. It's 2016. What happened to the great campaign of the regime changers?
I think to understand the war on Syria, you really have to go back and look at the entire operation referred to as the Arab Spring, because the Arab Spring was the buzzword of 2011, before the bombing of Libya. And the Arab Spring is sort of the official cover story behind the bombing of Libya, and it's the official cover story behind the covert war waged by the United States and its allies in Syria, against Syria, against the people of Syria. It's a covert war which is which relies almost exclusively on armed gangs, terrorist groups, death squads, essentially, who have multifarious nomenclature, all sorts of unpronounceable names that change all the time. And this avalanche, this sort of panoply of gangs, have been unleashed on Syria since 2011, since the very beginning of the destabilization of that country around the 17th of March 2011, when in the city of Daraa, which is on the border with Lebanon, in the south of Syria, you had a pretty small demonstration where you had snipers embedded in that demonstration, and the snipers shot eight Syrian policemen. And that was the start of the war in Syria. And those snipers were identified by the Syrian police. I was in Syria a couple of weeks after that happened, and saw extensive coverage of what happened, and you could actually see the snipers shooting. So that started the war. The use of unknown snipers, of course, this is a very tried and tested modus operandi of the Central Intelligence Agency. They've been doing this all over Latin America. They did this in Venezuela in 2002 when they instituted a coup d'etat against Chavez. And again, it involved demonstrations where you have unknown snipers who shoot on demonstrators, and then the media's role, the media's job, is to blame those killings on the targeted government, which is referred to as a regime.
Yeah.
So when you see in the media any government that is being referred to as a regime, you are talking about a U.S. regime change operation.
Mm-hmm.
So in Syria, since 2011, you've had these armed gangs who have been committing unspeakable atrocities against the Syrian people. And you have a very well-orchestrated international propaganda, war propaganda campaign, which relies on predominantly on human rights ideology. So you've got all these human rights groups.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most used groups for press agencies is the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It actually doesn't really exist. It was created by the British Foreign Office. And you'll in almost every report that you read, in any language, mm-hmm. whether it's French, English, German, any newspaper you pick up in Europe, or America, relies on reports from the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. What you're reading is the British press. You're essentially reading, the press releases of MI6, and that fools a lot of people. And then, of course, you have more sophisticated human rights organizations like Amnesty International, who are more well known, Human Rights Watch, and both of these organizations are heavily infiltrated and directed by both British and American intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of their top brass directors, have actually served in U.S. government.
Yeah, I have a memory that...
So you have a very broad international infrastructure of lies and disinformation, and that has been the main problem with the war. It would have been, I think, relatively easy for the Libyan army to defeat the al-Qaeda forces that were supported by NATO in Libya in 2011 if there had been international outrage,
mm-hmm.
In Europe and America. But there was no outrage. there was no real opposition to the war. The so-called anti-war movement that existed before the Iraq war and it brought millions of people on the streets, they were pretty much silenced. Now, that was because of the sophistication of the Arab Spring. And the Arab Spring was not a spontaneous uprising. It was not a grassroots uprising. It was not an uprising that got rid of U.S.-backed dictators. It was far more complex than that. And I said this at the start and got a lot of criticism for it. It was called all sorts of names for saying that, because yes, people tend to want to believe what they want. They will only believe what they want to believe, and it's not very rigorous, that. But I would like to have seen something like a real, genuine revolution happening, too. It wasn't. There was a real revolution in Egypt in 2013, when they got rid of the U.S.-backed dictator. It didn't lead to that much. I don't think it led to that much in Sisi, but there was a genuine uprising there. It was hardly even covered by the media. If you want to talk about a revolution in Egypt, it happened after the Arab Spring. So that's the mess that led to this, if you like. And that mess is being replicated in Burundi. The mess that's happening in Burundi is part of a much wider destabilization of Africa. There are civil society groups operating all over the African continent, almost every country. And it doesn't matter whether that country is ruled by a pro-US dictator or not. There are fake opposition groups that are ready to put pressure on whoever is running that country for geostrategic, geoeconomic, and geopolitical reasons.
Yeah. There, by the way, when I hear this civil society, it often it seems to almost equate with civil war. I remember seeing a quote. Maybe it was Mr. Bloom. I forget former CIA, but he's saying that you know the so-called civil society groups that are funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, et cetera, are basically doing in the open what the CIA used to do undercover.
Exactly, under their, I mean, on their own admission. The problem with a lot of the with the U.S. foreign policy strategy in the Cold War is that in order to repress labor, they had to install strongmen. So you had to get someone like Pinochet to run Chile, because you needed a militaristic fascist regime to crush labor. And Pinochet did his job, but in the end, he was actually more of a liability than an advantage to the United States. They discovered that a lot of the hardline dictators that they've installed did what most national leaders do, whether they're democratic or not. They'll engage in international commerce, and they'll inevitably do things that are not in the interest of the empire. And this is happening in a lot of Southern Hemisphere countries. So they decided, well, if we don't, there's such opposition, such hatred of Pinochet among the left in Chile, if we don't do something, then you could have a genuine, you know, kind of something like the Bolivarian Revolution, something like that could happen. You could have a genuine uprising against U.S. imperialism. So they decided to co-opt and preempt that by using these civil society groups. And the overthrow of Pinochet was pretty much that. I mean, it was kind of, it was all about getting rid of the dictator, but the economic dictatorship remained. And so it was an ingenious foreign policy strategy, and was replicated almost right across the world. And today they're basically doing that everywhere. Right now, I think you either get rid of a U.S.-backed dictator through blatant military force, like in the case of Saddam Hussein or Noriega in Panama, or you do it the clever way, which is through smart power, people power, social media, crowd leveraging, flash mob, this kind of ochlocratic method that they're using, which is just to get a lot of people out in the street and use them as a battering ram against the regime that has become recalcitrant for various reasons. And that was the case in Egypt with Mubarak. He had refused to send troops to Iraq, to occupy Iraq. U.S. needed, and Israel needed, Arab-speaking troops in Iraq. And, of course, he refused to go along with the U.S. post 9/11 agenda. In fact, Mubarak was himself a 9/11 truther. He didn't actually believe the U.S. story 9/11. So this is someone who was kind of, I think, once he saw what was happening in 2003 in Iraq, he was pretty much no longer in the U.S. camp. Mm-hmm. And Condoleezza Rice admitted that in a press conference a couple of years ago. She said there was a reason why Hosni Mubarak did not come back to the United States after 2003, and the reason was his refusal to go along with the neocon agenda of regime change in Iraq and the war against Iraq. Not saying for a moment that this is a good guy. It's just that they did want to get rid of him. They'd always preferred the Muslim Brotherhood because they're radical capitalists. They're radical neoliberal capitalists. Mm-hmm. And they'd never really, the West had never really been happy with secular regimes in the Middle East, because secular regimes tended to be more coherent, and there was a very high degree of coherent anti-Zionism mm-hmm. in these countries. One shouldn't forget that the PLO had their headquarters in Tunisia for many years.
Yeah. Well,
and so these countries were also more favorable to Gaddafi, and of course he was the real enemy in North Africa, because this is the only leader in the region who had real ideas and big ideas and big Pan-Africanist ideas. So all of that was going on, and you had Gaddafi's currency policies and unification of Africa, African Central Bank, all sorts of things that would have been wonderful for people living in Africa and for people in Europe, of course, because it would have meant that you would have had peace between the two continents.
Let me ask you, Gerald.
Now it's all of that just been destroyed, and so they're going kind of head on. They're going full on now into all over Africa with these youth movements, these civil society youth movements, which are nonsense organizations.
Yeah, and when they have meetings, the U.S. ambassador tends to attend them. I notice they. But I want to ask you: do you think they're really up against a problem now in Syria with their big campaigns? I just wonder, and also Burundi doesn't seem to be a pushover either. Do you think maybe they're off their game a little bit? Is it because of the changes in the attitude of Russia, China, and others? What do you attribute it to?
I think there is already a covert war going on in Africa, as far as I can see from my research in particularly the Francophone media in Africa itself, like in Cameroon, for example. There's definitely a covert war going on there between China and NATO. In this case, the French are the main power.
Yes, to a certain degree in Tanzania and Burundi.
Absolutely.
And East Namibia, Africa, places like that.
Yeah, in this case, we're kind of talking about East Africa, Central Africa. And there's no question about it that the Chinese have an interest in, I think, stabilizing Somalia. There's quite a lot of oil in Somalia. The West has an interest in just keeping instability. Instability is exactly what they want. Chaos is what they want. Mm-hmm. If they had just wanted oil in Libya, then they could easily have forced the Libyans, to give them more concessions. They could use their power. They can do these things. They already had the Iraqi oil. There was no need to invade Iraq for the oil. In fact, the only people who got most of the oil in the end were the Chinese. So, the invasion of Iraq is really about Israel's interests, strategic interests. Mm-hmm. In East Africa, we see a very strong Chinese presence. Kenya has moved very close to China. These are old historic contacts. This is an old historic relationship. I mean, East Africa had always been a major trading partner with India and China. And you see, relations with Kenya have deteriorated in recent years. Obama didn't even visit Kenya, I think, in his first visit to Africa, because Kenya is basically so pro-Chinese. Kenyatta, who was brought to the International Criminal Court, which is basically a neo-colonial kangaroo court for African leaders, predominantly. He was brought there and defended himself and was acquitted. You know, so there's a criminalization of any kind of African leader who is more pro-Chinese. And the thing is that they're all pro-Chinese because there is a kind of what I would call a yin and yang in international politics right now between countries who are building things and countries who are destroying things. And the Chinese are simply protecting their interests.
And this is creating a breathing space for countries like Burundi,
exactly.
And others. They have some choices.
The Chinese are pursuing their interests. They're pursuing they're looking for resources, mm-hmm. and but in exchange you're getting at least something with China. You get a certain degree of technology transfer. You get construction. Roads and bridges are being built. Now, the Chinese are only building these roads because they want to get access to those resources. But you do get some kind of construction. You get loans that have much better terms. You get, interest. A lot of the banking arrangements with China are much better. And so China is offering much better terms to African countries. So all African leaders, doesn't matter who they are, they all tend to be more pro-Chinese. So the Chinese are kind of, maybe the yang and the Western countries are the yin. They're just into destruction. They're bombing, terrorist gangs, destabilization, invasion, demonization, sanctions, you know. So at the very least, the Chinese, if you compare the Chinese empire to the American empire, the Chinese empire has the advantage for developing countries that it's constructivist.
Wow.
The Chinese are not going to come in and foment a coup d'etat. They're not going to come in and support a terrorist gang. They're not going to blow your country to bits, you know. So anyone who's sensible is going to want to go to Beijing nowadays. And that's basically what's happening in East Africa. Tanzania is the same thing. Uganda has very much gravitated towards China and Russia. If you listen to the speeches of Yoweri Museveni, who's by no means, a good leader, and if you look at his past, he's got a lot of blood in his hands in Congo, and this is a U.S. collaborator. But now he's kind of changed camp because he can obviously see that
it wasn't. It's not the first time he has changed, by the way.
Yeah.
He's been pretty slippery. Gerald, it's great to talk to you, and your journalism is outstanding. We're very grateful, and I'm sorry we kept you up so late.
No problem.
All right. Look forward to talking to you. Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you again soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Gerald O'Coleman. And there is a website, GeraldO'Coleman.com. You can find him. By the time I finish talking, you've already looked him up anyhow. But the idea that anybody needs much explanation, probably about 2 minutes into most interviews, people already get to Google and they know all about whoever is on they're talking to.